Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of July. Jim Harris is with us in our Milwaukee studio now. Jim is co-chair of We Help War Victims, an organization that assists survivors of war and other conflict to rebuild their lives. Since 2000, the organization's main effort has been to assist Hmong and Lao families who have been hurt by the Indochina War. He's also employed as a project manager by Phoenix Clearance, a company doing clearance of unexploded ordnance in Laos. And since the year 2000, Jim has made many trips to Laos to help remove these ordinances and to deliver medical supplies and school libraries to needy villages. He was a classroom teacher for a number of years, a school administrator for a number of years. As you know, the first Hmong refugees to arrive in Wausau, Wisconsin came in 75, and over time, many others have joined those first refugees. We'll talk about the work that Jim has done, well, all over the world, in Laos and also with these families where he's taught the children, made school presentations when he returns from Laos. And he is with us in our studio now wearing a T-shirt that says Ban Cluster Bombs. And we'll talk about a treaty that he's interested in getting passed to ban those very cluster bombs. He's with us here and we'll be welcoming phone calls. He is also the only American, I believe, in Laos working in the field and has his many friends. He has more than this, but he has pictures surrounding him of his many friends who he tells them that he's letting people in America know about them. And indeed, he will this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Jim. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Who are all your friends you have pictures of all over the studio?
I live in a village on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and I have a project that serves people in 16 villages. And every time I go into a village, I meet local people who've been victims of leftover ordnance. And I've made friends with people. I have friends who have lost arms. I've had friends who have lost legs. I have friends who've had their children killed by bombs. I've had children whose parents have been killed by bombs. And one of the hardest things for me living there is trying to think of something to say when I know that these victims are the victims of American ordnance. And inevitably, I tell them that I will do what I can do to help the next person not become a victim. And I will go to America and I'll tell people their experience. So I have the pictures in front of me today as a touchstone. I will go back to Laos in another couple of months. And when I see my friends, I'll tell them I fulfilled my promise. I told America about their tragedies.
Why are there so many of these cluster bombs still there? This war was over some time ago.
Yeah, the war ended 35 years ago.
Oh, my gosh, 35 years ago.
Yeah, and the problem started with the nature of the ordnance. A lot of the ordnance did not explode as intended. A lot of the ordnance was used in civilian areas, even though they were intended to be used on military targets. And the volume of ordnance. Laos is the most heavily bombed country in the history of the world.
Really?
America dropped 4 million big bombs. Bombs 100.
4 million?
4 million, 100 pound, 250, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. Those big bombs, we dropped 4 million of them on Laos. And we dropped tens of million of cluster munitions. To this day, we find about 10 to 30% of that ordnance never went off. And where I live on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the land is just impregnated.
And you are the only American in the field at this point who's working with a demolition squad to rid the countryside of these bombs?
Yeah, there's some accountants in the who look after American donations, but I'm the only American who actually lives and works in the field and works with ordnance on a day-to-day basis.
Don't we have some responsibility as a government? Was there not a treaty signed of some kind that you will remove these bombs once you have left?
Yeah, we've moved on. You know, America gets distracted. Americans have the habit of a war ending and we all come home. We don't have much experience in this country with a war ending and then having to rebuild our physical countryside. And so it's easy for us to forget. We get on with our lives. The war has been over for 35 years, and since the fighting stopped, there have been 22,000 casualties in Laos to leftover ordnance, and about half of those have been children.
Mm. So you've brought these people with you in the studio to let them know that we now know about what's happening, because most people don't know what's happening, I think, Jim.
We called that involvement the secret war.
Right.
And it raged on from 1964 to 1973. And during that time, Americans were not given a lot of information about it. So Americans today will say, I never knew. And increasingly, 35 years is a long time. There are a lot of listeners out on your program today who weren't even born when these bombs were dropped in Laos. And there are a lot of people who might have to go to an atlas today to look up and find out where Laos is.
Right.
But it's the most heavily bombed country in the world, and it's the most contaminated with submunitions.
Mm. So how did you know they were all there? Was it a result of the refugees who came to the Wausau area that you were teaching, or how did you learn?
Yeah, I had the lucky situation in my life that during summers, when I was teaching, when I was a school principal, I could typically get off for a vacation. And when I got to know the Hmong refugees in Wausau, I realized these people had left Laos with just the clothes on their back. And they were never going to see relatives they left behind. They were never going to see the village they left behind. So I started 10 years ago traveling to Laos to reconnect families. And they would draw me maps of how to find their village. They'd tell me stories about their family. And then during the summer, I would go off looking for them. And as a consequence, I found myself up in the mountains of northern Laos in remote areas, tramping around, looking in villages to find somebody's grandmother, somebody's brother, somebody's cousin. In doing that, I very quickly learned about unexploded ordnance, because that part of Laos where I was looking for these extended families is blighted with ordnance. And so people would say, well, nice to have you here, but be careful where you put your feet. The other thing that opened my eyes was when you get into these remote villages, you discover all the unmet needs in education, in healthcare. And so I started taking supplies to Laos. And we built libraries in Laos villages, and we helped people get medical care for conditions. We took medical supplies. And then I started taking bomb removal supplies to the few groups that were up there doing work, and befriended the bomb removal crew, and ultimately decided to join them and do that work.
And did you find relatives? Did you find connections between did you really?
Every summer I would come back.
Isn't that something?
And I would deliver video letters from their family, and I would show pictures to children of the grandparents they'd never seen. And it was exciting. So one task led to another, and I started going into Laos almost every summer. So over 10 years, I've spent a lot of time in Laos.
And you're also doing presentations to people in the state of Wisconsin. I saw on public television you presenting to a group of school children who were captivated by what you said, had no idea what was going on, and were really taken by the prosthetic hand that you showed, which are available in medical facilities there because of the cluster bombs, right?
Right, right. I spend about half of every year in Laos. When I'm not there, I come back and try to do what I can to educate the public. It's one of the reasons I'm deeply appreciative of this opportunity. There are listeners out there today who have no idea about the depth of this problem. And so I try to use my time in Wisconsin to visit groups, spread the word, raise consciousness. And then we're also raising funds to go back and do clearance.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way for you to do this on a larger level? I mean, I'm a little bit concerned that the task is so enormous and you're one person who's doing marvelous work, but wouldn't it be nice if the government would take responsibility for ridding Laos of these bombs?
Yeah. It will take millions, if not billions of dollars to clear up all the mess that we've left behind. And you're right, one person, and even with generous donors around the cities of Wisconsin, I can't raise millions of dollars. But there are some things that I can do. This project that we want to do in the fall is going to a neglected area. And I'd heard about districts up north near the China border that had been bombed heavily during the war. I went there in March, and sure enough, every place I went, there was ordnance. A blacksmith showed me a bomb under the tree outside his house. A little boy took me to his family rice garden, showed me a bomb that his family's gardening around. Mm. A young man took me to his father's grave and showed me where his to the rice field where his father had been killed. And this part of Laos had never, in 35 years, had any service. So I'm hoping to raise the money to take my team up there for 2 months. What we'll do is to document the depth of the problem. We'll show the successes that we can have. And if I come back after 2 months with that sort of documentation, then I can go maybe to the U.S. government or some of the major international donors, and I can convince them that Ponce Lead Province needs to be on their radar screen.
Mm-hmm. And who's on your team?
Well, when I work in Laos, I have a 6-person rapid response team, and we have deminers, a medic, a driver, me, and we tell the people in 16 villages that if they find any ordnance anywhere in their life, let Mr. Jim know. Now, I'm the only white guy in 16 villages, and that's part of the design of the program is I'm very easy to find.
I guess you would be.
And people stop me in the market, they come to my house, they flag down my car, and they tell us they found ordnance. We tell them, you let Mr. Jim know, and I'll have my team there to blow it up within 48 hours. The first 6 months I had the job, we blew up 1,000 bombs.
1,000 bombs?
1,000 bombs in the first 6 months. At the end of the year, I'd counted, we tallied 1,600. And I've been doing this work for 3.5 years. We've simply stopped counting. People find them in their rice garden. They find them along the riverbank when they're fishing. They find them in the woods when they're digging bamboo shoots, in the pasture when they're herding water buffalo. We've even found them inside a one-room school. Yeah, a teacher in my village had just about had enough of her chalkboard listing to one side, and so she decided she'd dig a little hole in the dirt floor of the classroom, and she'd level her chalkboard. And she got down about 6 inches and clink. And she had to decide, do I go on teaching today or do I? Well, she sent the kids to find Mr. Jim. When we got there, sure enough, she had a bomb in her classroom. And we had to, we dug sandbags like crazy, and we were able to destroy that bomblet inside her school without knocking the walls or taking off the roof.
And she could have been killed digging there trying to balance the chalkboard.
Oh, and 50 students. You know,
these
people look at these small munitions. You know, if I had one with me, I could show you. The submunitions come in a variety of forms. There are 210 different varieties that have been developed. But the one that's most common in Laos is about the size of a tennis ball. People look at it in America and say, well, how dangerous could that be? But it's got 70 grams of high explosive inside and 300 steel ball bearings. So when it goes off, it's a very effective killer if you're within 30 yards, can kill you up to 100 yards away. When we blow them up, we go 350 yards away and stand behind a tree.
Mm. Were they indiscriminately placed, do you think?
Well, that's the nature of these cluster munitions, and it's the reason that, based on my experience, that I'm so opposed to their continued use. They were intended to be used against military targets, personnel, or lightly guarded vehicles. But the problem was that over the years of warfare, they became carelessly used and dropped in areas with a lot of civilian population. And then because they're indiscriminate, they scatter and hit civilians as well as military. But they also have a very high dud rate. You know, 10 to 30% of them never went off as intended. Mm. And that's why we end up with 12 million of them scattered around the countryside.
I'm astounded by the numbers here, just astounded.
Yeah, it's hard on a program like this for me not to use a lot of numbers, and I don't want to have your listeners' heads spinning with numbers, but America flew 580,000 bomb runs over Laos. That's the equivalent of a B-52 bomb load being dropped every 8 minutes around the clock for 9 years. It's staggering. One canister of cluster munitions, the one that we, that our biggest problem is with what we call the Bomb Live Unit 26 or BLU 26. That canister falls out of a plane. It's a canister about 7 feet long and maybe 18 inches wide, falls out of the plane, opens like a clamshell. Out of that clamshell come 670 bomblets, each with 300 steel ball bearings and 70 grams of TNT. When those bomblets go off, they wipe out everything over 3 football fields. And if 10 to 30% don't go off, that area should be uninhabitable. Nobody would voluntarily choose to live there. Unfortunately for the people of Laos, that's their rice field, it's their pasture for their cows, it's their area where they forage for food. And they have no choice but to live there among all that clutter.
Are these being used elsewhere now?
Cluster munitions have been used in over 30 countries in the world. And there isn't one country in which they've ever been used that has cleaned up the problem 100%. Every place they've ever been used to this day still lives with contamination. We international abhorrence of this kind of weapon started in the late 60s and 70s when the world became aware of the manner in which we were using them in Laos. But when that conflict ended, the movement to ban them kind of lost traction. But it picked up again most stridently after the most recent Israeli conflict in southern Lebanon. In a 34-day fighting period, Lebanon dropped over 4 million submunitions on southern Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And they had a very high rate of dud. They estimate there about 25% never went off. And those were American made. Many of those were Vietnam era weapons. Mm-hmm. America has a tremendous, tremendous stockpile of these. America acknowledges the existence of 728 million. Cluster bombs in our arsenal, and it may well be higher than that.
The president, as you know, was in Russia recently, and they were making some progress on trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons on both sides. Is the issue of cluster bombs on the president's radar at all?
Well, when he was a senator, his voting record had him in support of a moratorium on their export to other countries, and his staff has told those of us who are working for participation in the treaty that he will give it an open-minded consideration, and I'm optimistic that he will. So we can hope. The interest that he has in nuclear proliferation is encouraging. I call the cluster munitions, you know, weapons of mass destruction in slow motion.
Let's welcome phone calls for Jim. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Jim Harris is our guest this hour, co-chair of We Help War Victims, an organization that assists survivors of war and other conflict to rebuild their lives. He's been spending half the year in Laos, where he works with families who have been hurt, particularly by cluster bombs, and he's educating us as to the number of bombs that are found there, incredible number, and what he's doing to ban cluster bombs and gather support and bring the world's attention and Wisconsin's attention right now to this issue. He is surrounded by pictures he's taken of people who have lost family members due to the explosion of these weapons or lost limbs as a result of this. So we're going to take your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Tyler from Oshkosh. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. Hello. Good morning.
Hello.
I just have a quick question. I had seen a television program, and I believe it was on Laos, and it focused on the fact that some children had a tendency to collect some of the smaller unexploded ordnance and attempt to possibly sell them or, you know, make some form of profit off of them. I also saw images of larger ordnance being used in people's houses. They were using the large shells to build structures out of. Is there a campaign to maybe a literature campaign that's been spread out to inform children and other adults, you know, explicitly not to touch these ordnance at all?
Yeah, you raised a very good point. We've just recently completed a very comprehensive survey in Laos about how accidents occur and who's involved with them. And we know now, on the basis of that survey, that about half of the victims are children. And some of that is because the children are opportunistic. They're out trying to collect metal that they can use for recycling. Sometimes they're trying to collect valuable items that they can bring back because they see in their families that family members will take the recycled metal and forge it into a knife or a hoe. They may take a empty bombi shell and turn it into a lamp, a cooking pan. It's a very, very poor country, so people are opportunistic about using these recycled goods and about turning them in for a profit. The problem is, in terms of risk education, trying to convince children that they shouldn't participate. The problem is that there's nothing else that's going to happen after you give the warning. Now, I've been in many schools, and I give a powerful presentation to children saying, if you find a bomb, don't touch it. Tell your teacher. Tell your parent. Go find the village chief. Tell him. But the reality, the sad reality, is nobody's coming to do anything about it. You know, this isn't, Laos isn't like America where you've got a problem, you call the fire department and somebody shows up to help you out. In Laos, if you find a bomb and you don't touch it, well, be prepared to live with it for 30 years. So telling children who find a bomb on the trail to school, don't touch it, step over it. Telling the child who finds one in the rice field, don't touch it, hoe around it. There's nobody coming to take that away. I mentioned that I work for 16 villages, 6,500 people. Well, there are 6,558 villages in Laos. I work with 6,500 people. There are almost 7 million people in Laos. Most of those people are getting no service. So it's very hard to construct a message that says, be careful and learn how to be safe around ordnance when the ordnance is going to be there for a long, long time.
Are there other countries that have stepped up to the plate here to do the work that you're doing?
Yeah, and thank goodness for Great Britain. Has a very big presence there with the Mine Advisory Group, or MAG. It's a wonderful group that won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for their work. They have a presence. Japanese government is there. I'm kind of proud to be from Wisconsin with our Norwegian population because Norwegian People's Aid has stepped up. Norway gives more money for the cleanup than America gives.
Really?
So I'm thankful for the help we're getting from Norway. Denmark gives more money for cleanup than America gives.
Why?
All I can say is America tends to go on to the next issue. We lose sight of what we've done in the past. You know, friends of mine tell me, "Oh, Jim, you're stuck in the 1970s. You got to get on with life. This is NOM." And I used to say, I'm doing this so my grandson won't have to do it. But the reality is this is going to be with us for a long, long time. And we either turn our back on it and move away or we do what is the responsible thing, and that is clean up the mess that we made.
Yeah. Thanks, Tyler, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. Laura from New Berlin. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Jim, and thanks for what you both do. And I'm glad you're stuck in the 70s, Jim. I just wondered if you have any insight into the minds that invented these devices. For instance, what kind of academic background, what kind of corporations or the names of corporations they were paid by, and maybe even any idea what kind of retirement these developers are now having.
Sure. You know, the cluster munitions first appeared on the world scene during World War 1942. Mm-hmm. And in 1943, Germany was dropping butterfly bombs on England. The Russians used them during the war. But they really became an important part of our arsenal during the war in Indochina. Those of us who were alive during the 1970s remember Minneapolis and the Honeywell Project, mm-hmm. because it was Honeywell, the American corporation, that was responsible for making these. And there are still Americans, American companies that make the components of these. And hopefully that if the rest of the world turns its back on these as ordnance, and there are over 100 nations now that have pledged to join the new treaty that was just negotiated in Oslo in 2008. And interestingly, even though America has not joined in either the negotiation of that treaty or its ratification, some of our major allies have. So we're in a situation in America where we're looking at France and England and Japan and Germany have all signed on to ratify the Cluster Munitions Treaty and have pledged to destroy their stockpile of ordnance and to never use it again.
Anything else, Laura?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. And why the reluctance on the part of the U.S. to join in?
You know, I think if you ask the military about whether they need a weapon, the answer almost always is yes. And it really takes kind of civilian diplomacy to draw a line and to say, you know, you might like to have mustard gas, you might like to have hollow nose, you might like to have a thermonuclear device, you might like to have cluster munitions and landmines, but the civilian population has to stand up and draw a line. Your previous caller asked about the mindset. You know, there's an interesting quote from Curtis LeMay, who was the Air Force Chief of Staff. He had to go before the Senate and justify adding to our nuclear arsenal. And they asked him, they said, General LeMay, we already have enough nuclear weapons to reduce the Soviet Union to cinders. Why do we need more? And his response was, I want to see those cinders dance.
Oh, my gosh.
So you take that mindset and apply it to cluster munitions and landmines. It's the reason we have 728 million in storage waiting for use.
In storage, how many?
728 million.
Wow. Thanks for your call, Laura. Let's go to Daryl next from La Couture. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and your guest.
Hi, Daryl.
I was listening this morning, and I was remembering when those bombs were dropped, I was in the Air Force. And my first job in the Air Force was painting a billboard-sized sign outside of Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota, and the sign only said, "Peace is our profession." As I watched the KC-135 tankers and B-52 bombers fly over me, going to that part of the world. Thank you for the show.
Thank you, Daryl, very much for your call. What do you, when you bring these stories home to school children, to various people, what do you, particularly from school children, what do you hear? What is their response to this?
You know, I find Wisconsin school children to be very empathetic. And because I'm able to come back and give not just statistics, but I'm able to come back and make people understand the real people. You know, my friend Ta without arms, my friend Kong, whose 9-year-old son was killed. A boy in our village, Lone, who was killed digging fishing worms. You know, they become real people. And children have been very generous. I've received more financial help for our work from school groups than any other demographic. So the kids understand. And it's an issue for them. We always say, oh, there are future leaders. You know, I tell children, it isn't future leadership. You can lead today. Mm. And I get some very remarkable things happening out of Wisconsin schools in support of these issues.
Mm-hmm. And you're also doing, as you said earlier, medical supplies, but you're also bringing schools to Laos, right? Schools in a box. Can you tell me more about that program?
We have a project that we call Book box libraries. We have in each box we have 200 books. We insist that they be in the Lao language. We don't take discarded English language books. They have to be in the native language, and we put them in a very sturdy box that has built-in shelves, and then donate that to a village. Inevitably, they're the first books in a village school, the first books in a village. And it's fun for me to go back a year after they've been delivered to see children in school reading, and after school hours, seeing parents come to the school to borrow a book to take home. Wisconsin people, individuals, schools, and churches have sent libraries to 40 schools in Laos. I'm in the bomb business, not the book business, but when I'm going, and if I can do two things at one time, we try to take medical supplies to hospitals, libraries to schools. The needs are pretty great in Laos. It's by general consensus, it's one of the 10 poorest countries in the world.
And what about in Laos? Are you greeted with some, well, you've been going there for a number of years now, but were you initially greeted with some suspicion, or people understood who you are and what your mission is right off the bat?
Yeah. There will always be some Lao government suspicion. You know, if you start doing bomb removal, you're walking around the country with camera and GPS unit and a backpack of TNT. And given our rocky relationship with the country of Laos, you could understand that they're not real eager to have a lot of Americans in that role. But on a person-to-person level, one of the things, frankly, I do not understand it, is the generosity of the Lao people. I've held the hand of a sobbing mother whose child was just killed by an American bomb. I've never had a person say a harsh word to me as an American to damn me for this ordinance or for the reason it's there in their country. It's a remarkable attribute of the people in Laos that they are very understanding. They separate people from government. And I've never had a harsh word or a confrontation with people, even those who've been victims. Mm.
Let's go to Kevin from Eau Claire next. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to know more information on where to make donations and possibly volunteer my own time and money to help this.
Well, that's great. As I said, we are doing fundraising, hoping to be able to take this rapid response team. We have an organization called We Help War Victims, and our website is wehelpwarvictims.org. No spaces, just wehelpwarvictims.org. And on that site, there is an easy path to making a donation. In terms of volunteering, there are lots of things that a volunteer could do in Laos. It's problematic in terms of taking volunteers into an area with contaminated land. I spend all day, every day, on contaminated land, and I just accept that as an occupational hazard. But the other side of that is that a volunteer who comes in, even if they say they would accept that risk, they put other people at risk. A good number of accident victims in Laos had the unfortunate circumstance to just be a bystander when somebody else made a mistake. And so it's hard. It's not to say it can't happen, but it's difficult to include volunteers in our operation unless the person has been very, very well trained and understands the nature of the problem in Laos.
Mm-hmm. You got the website, though, Kevin?
What is the website again?
Wehelpwarvictims.org.
Thank you for my call, taking my call.
You know, when I live in Laos, I'm in a village without electricity and without running water. There's not a lot of entertainment. So to keep my sanity, I do a lot of writing. And it's a socially acceptable way to talk to yourself. And Over 3 years, I've maintained a journal with stories of the people, not all bomb removal. I've got stories about food and insects and just lots of stories. And if at my website, I post those. I'm probably have over 100,000 words, maybe 80 or 90 articles that I've written. So if you have a general interest in Laos, not just ordnance, but you can go to that website and call up some of those articles. You might find them interesting.
Thanks for the call. This must have been something you thought about, at least initially. This occupational hazard that you have is a pretty big occupational hazard, isn't it?
My job is interesting. Some days are more interesting than others. Some days are absolutely fascinating. But I take my hat off to the people I work with. My team of young men and women are people in their 20s. They have their whole lives ahead of them. Some of them are parents to young children. I get to come home every few months to America and recharge my batteries. They live there year-round. And in terms of the people who are taking a risk trying to make life better for the Laotian, my hat is off to my team, the dedication, the courage that they show on a day-to-day basis. The truth is, my job, you could train a chimpanzee to do my job. Villagers get me. They take me to show me the ordnance that they found. And so every day I get a long walk through the jungle. And when I get to the ordnance that they found, my job is to clear the brush around it so we can find it easily again. I spray things with paint. I put up a sign. I break tree branches. And then I go back and get the team. And because I've been there first, we haven't lost a lot of time with the team walking through the forest and then showing up without the right supplies. So, you know, I always tell people, Lassie could do my job, but it's the other guys on the team who do this job day in and day out. You know, Kathleen mentioned, I'm the only American in Laos doing the work. Well, I'm not there today. I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That means there is no American in Laos today working in the field to clear this ordinance. And I think the victims deserve to meet an American. Time and time again, somebody in Laos will say, you know, you're the first American I've ever met. I would like the first American they meet to be somebody clearing ordinance for them.
You're the first American I've ever met, they say. Isn't that amazing? And how somehow we need to realize that we have a responsibility to clean up such a deadly mess that was left behind. It's extraordinary. Gary from Minnesota is next. Hi, Gary.
Morning. The main problem, as I see it, is that there are no real consequences to the decisions of the people that make these things. They don't have to pay for the burial of the people that these things kill. They don't have to pay for any of the hospital costs. They are making tons of money doing this. If they were required to bury some of these things in their backyard where their kids were playing, I don't think they'd be doing this. So until we change the system so that there are consequences to these decisions, I don't think it's going to change.
You know, sadly, during the most recent conflict in Iraq, some American soldiers have been killed by our own ordnance. I met a woman named Lynn Braddock from Portland, Oregon, and we share an interest in this issue. And her interest comes from the fact that her son, an American soldier in Iraq, was killed by a cluster munition. And some commanders during the most recent war in Iraq refused to use the ordnance. And they took the position, one, that they couldn't properly discriminate between civilians and military targets, and two, they did not want the responsibility of their own troops, our own troops, American troops, progressing through area that we've just contaminated. So it's a very small minority of people who've paid a price for these, but my friend Lynn Braddock lost a son. That's a high price to pay.
Yes, it is. Thanks for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Jim Harris is our guest this hour, co-chair of We Help War Victims. You can find out more about what we speak this hour by going to their website, which is wehelpwarvictimsalltogether.org. He spends half of his year in Laos, and he's helped in a number of ways. His position right now is to clear lands to get rid of cluster bombs, and there are many, many, many thousands of them, and many thousands of people have lost their lives in the past 35 years it's taken to remove some of these cluster bombs. He would like, of course, all of them gone, and I guess one of the questions of the hour is why those responsible for putting them there have not taken the responsibility to remove them so people won't die or be badly maimed as a result of they're detonating in the many years since the war ended. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to send an email, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I just want to remind you that we're taking this. I bring this up. We had everything filled, and then we had such a response that we decided to add a second bus. We're going to Springfield, Illinois on October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th to celebrate Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. We'll have Lincoln scholars on the trip with us. We're going to New Salem, which is where he learned law himself. We'll be going to the relatively new Lincoln Museum, and we'll have scholars on the bus. Scholars will give special presentations when we're there. We have a few seats left on a second bus, and we'd like to fill this as soon as we can. So if you're interested, please, we're going to have a great time. Call Lisa for our Springfield trip, 414-390-1073, and we'd love to have you on the trip. Let's take some more phone calls for Jim. Rich from Sullivan, hi.
Hi. This may seem a little bit far-ranging, but I'm old enough to have grown up in the era of Edward R. Murrow. And at the time I was a kid, there was a documentary made called Harvest of Shame. It was about American migrant workers. And I know that firsthand because I went into a program, a national program, to work with migrant labor in South Texas. And that's nothing special to my credit. Many people did. It's nothing like what this man is doing. But my question is, I just got over 10 days, 2 weeks of hearing, reading nothing but about a tragic individual life, Michael Jackson. I don't want to subtract from that tragedy in any way, but a lot of it seemed to me to be pure junk and pure sentimentality about someone who had gone the wrong direction in life. What is the mainstream American media's interest in this issue? Because when I flip on my TV set, if I'm away from the Bill Moyers Journal or something like that, there's no program to make us knowledgeable about what Eisenhower warned us against, a military-industrial complex that leaves this sort of legacy of shame. I tuned in late, so I don't know. Are there documentaries that can be taken around and shown? Or I know about Princess Di and stuff like that, but it just seems that there's a blackout.
Right. You're right, Rick. Yep. Yeah.
The two best productions are a program called Bombies, and Bombie is the term that the Lao used to refer to cluster munitions, and that was directed and filmed by an American producer called director-producer called Jack Silberman. That's Bombies. It's a bit of a stretch looking for it, but that's an hour-long documentary. The more recent one is an Australian film called Bomb Harvest. And it's received standing ovations in theaters throughout Australia. And either one of those two, if you belong to a civic group or an institution would like to learn more about this issue, I'd recommend either Bombies or Bomb Harvest.
Hmm. You there, Rich? Okay. Thanks very much for the call. And I know that you have done presentations. I know you're in Laos for half the year and half the year here. Is there a display? The pictures that you've brought are very, very moving. Do you travel with those anywhere, Jim?
Oh, yeah. I have an excellent collection of artifacts related to UXO removal, and I take those from place to place. I have my photographs, the usual PowerPoint. The other thing is I've been producing some videos. I had a special interest in child scrap collecting, and I was trying to create enough public outrage in Laos that maybe I could have something happen there. And I'm optimistic that I will, but I've produced some videos that have been used by UNICEF and other groups in Laos to discourage that. So, yeah, it's interesting, though. The one of the things that motivated me to go to Laos and do the removal myself was a fellow at First English Lutheran Church in Wausau. I was there on a Sunday morning, and I presented to his group. And at the end of my presentation, he said, "You know, Jim, you need to get a bigger microphone, a bigger megaphone. You need a taller soapbox." He said, "We're only 35 people in this basement." And I thought, well, yeah, maybe I do need to reach out and raise more consciousness. But then it dawned on me that consciousness raising doesn't remove a single bomb. And I've raised a lot of consciousness in Wisconsin, throughout the Midwest, maybe in America. But knowing about the problem doesn't change anything. And it was in response to that congregant's comment that I decided I'm going to allow and I'm going to remove the bombs. And
oh, my. That's how that happened. Pao is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Pao.
Hi, good morning. I was born in Laos, and I grew up in America. And in the time I was in Laos, I lost an uncle because of those cluster bombs that Jim talked about. And I realized that the program or the money that being sent to Laos, I believe that some of those money didn't really get through the remote area in Laos to educate the, especially the Hmong kids in the hill tribe, you know, the hill tribes in the hills, where the government program did not reach out to the remote area in Laos. And I was wondering if we help the or have a program like this to send to Laos, well, those people in the remote area are getting any help.
Yeah. Well, we're not sending much money. The cost of the bombing campaign in Laos over 9 years was $150 billion. Now, in 1969 dollars, that comes out to about $2.5 million a day. $2.5 million a day times 365 times 9 years, that's the cost of getting that ordinance there. Today, America gives less than $2.5 million for the cleanup per year. So, those are 2009 dollars. So, there's not much. But, you know, the reason I'm going back in November is to go to an area, as you say, the hill villages that have never received services before.
Thanks for the call, Powell. Let's go to Tom from Sheboygan. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I just caught the tail end of the program here. I'm in a group called Veterans for Peace. And I guess instead of reveling in our glory or the glory of our service to our country, our group I believe is more sees it more as atoning for what we did instead of working for putting Army tanks in parks, we question those in authority. We try to educate people about the military-industrial complex and how much it's costing us in money and in just in other ways. And we fully agree with a lot of the things your guest has been saying on the program.
Yeah, a good high school buddy of mine who was a Vietnam vet told me that if I ran into an amputee who needed a leg, I could count on him. He had no idea how easy it was going to be. Sure enough, within weeks of my returning to Lao, I found a 22-year-old man named Yot who had lost a leg to a cluster munition. And my high school buddy sent me $200, and that was in March. Yot today is wearing his leg, and he's in a rice field. He's a farmer again. He's providing for his family. It doesn't take a lot to put somebody literally back on their feet in Lao.
Thanks very much for your call. Well, darn, we're out of time. So if people want more information, if they want to contribute, can you do everything with that website,
Jim? That website's a very good start.
That's a good start. And once again, it is?
WeHelpWarVictims.org.
WeHelpWarVictims.org. Thank you so much for coming to see us and bringing all the pictures and for all of the work that you're doing.
It's great to have Wisconsin Public Radio, Milwaukee Public Radio, people who said they don't get this news anyplace else. They find it here.
Yeah, they do. Thank you, Jim. Jim Harris, our guest. We thank him so much for being with us. Just a few announcements for you. One is confirmation hearings on Sonia Sotomayor's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court begin today. They will last 4 days. You can hear a one-hour wrap-up of the day's events, 6 o'clock on the Ideas Network. It will air in place of the first hour of On Point and also coverage of the hearings during Talk of the Nation. Just for your information. Also, I want to remind you that we are doing special health care reform programs looking at other countries, although tomorrow at 10, we'll be looking at the history of health care in the United States. We'll have two great guests with us. And then the next Tuesday at 10, it will be France. Thanks. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very interesting and important hour. And thanks to Jolema Noel and to Rachel Biblow for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.